This evening, I'd like to take a topic that is sometimes considered quite unpopular to hear about and see if I can make it, I don't know if popular is the right word, but certainly more attractive rather than the unattractive. And some of it has to do with perhaps a mistranslation into English of a Pali word. And the topic, today's, once a month I teach a Friday, day-long retreat, which I did last Friday, on the perfections. There's 10 perfections, 10 qualities that of character that get cultivated and developed that are really very helpful for the contemplative life, for doing living the spiritual life, for engaging in meditation practice. And some people will actually cultivate and develop these qualities so that when they sit down on the cushion to meditate, there's strength of character that comes along and makes it easier to stay present and get concentrated. And these things are things like a strong sense of quality of generosity, generous heart, a strong feeling of integrity, and then the topic of today, and then a strong ability of applying oneself, of giving energy, a strong ability of wisdom, having a strong sense of wisdom or insight, understanding what you're doing. And then there's patience, and there's honesty or truth-telling, being very knowing the truth. There is determination. A person has a strong sense of inner determination or will in Western terms. Often can make much more progress in meditation than someone who doesn't have much determination or will or resolve. And then equanimity and loving kindness. So those are 10 qualities that are said to enhance and support the spiritual life, contemplative life. You're welcome just to ignore those if you'd like. Or you could take them as something to be cultivated in daily life. They're often considered daily life practices to some degree. And as we apply and develop these areas of our life, then that in return feeds back and supports the meditation practice. So today's topic is the third one, the one I haven't translated for you yet. And the Pali word is nekama, neck, like neck here, and then like kama, nekama. And the question is, what does that term mean? It's usually translated into English as renunciation. And now you understand why it's unpopular topic. And renunciation, for some people, has very frightening associations, that word. Some people come from a certain religious heritage where renunciation was a really important part of the particular religion they were part of, and it was really ugly what that entailed. So recently I watched a video, a movie called The Bernadette Sisters. Some of you have seen that? What was it called? Magdalena, yeah, the Magdalena Sisters. And that frightened me. And there was a lot of renunciation there. And the idea of, renouncing a lot of things that maybe people should never renounce. Renouncing our sense of self-determination or our ability to choose for ourselves or know for ourselves what's wise and what's not. Renouncing is a kind of penance, or renouncing is a kind of that diminishes us and cuts us off and shuts off parts of who we are. And maybe some of you have come out of religious traditions where renunciation was considered a very important part of the tradition to some degree. And it was really not such a pleasant experience, the way it was treated and the way it was looked at. So I can certainly understand that people hear the word renunciation, some people, their guard goes up very quickly. But maybe the word nekkama should not be translated as renunciation. After all, the Buddha didn't speak English. The word nekkama is made up of two parts. And the ne part, the prefix, means, in this context, means out. So outwardly, out. And kama, the kama here has the meaning of to walk or to go. So to walk out or to go out, some people translated it as to come out. So to go out, to come out, some people translate it as going forth. And it's a synonym, or it's one of the words used for someone who becomes a Buddhist monastic. They go forth. And we usually think go forth into the monastic life, but also the meaning is they go out of the household life. They come out of the life of the home. Now, one of the understandings of going out in this tradition, or going forth, is you're going forth into vast, clear, open space. So if you can imagine yourself in a small cabin in the really heavy rainy season or snow or something, blizzard, and you're with, you know, a full collection of all your relatives, and or somebody like that, I don't know. And, you know, it's wonderful, the first day, the second day, the third day, the first week, the second week. But after a while, you get cabin fever. You're all on top of each other, and there's really this cabin fever. And then finally, the storm clears, and you can go outside, and you can go out into the open space, the blue, beautiful blue sky, and you feel like it's this great relief and this great ease and peace and openness and relaxation that happens as you go forth. You come out of that that more confined kind of situation. So the word nekama has this meaning of meaning of going forth into open space, or coming out of a place that's confined or constricted. So it's going from a situation that's confining to a situation of more that's more free, that's free. So I don't know if renunciation is the right translation for this, but maybe it's the closest to English, because there is an aspect of letting go of something. So for monastic, they're letting go of what they call in Buddhism the household way, the way of living domestically. So being in sexual relationships, intimate relationships, living with children and houses and mortgages and, you know, all those things. And I know that some monastics find this very delightful, not to have these things around. You know, sometimes it can feel very confining. Sometimes at my house, around 10 to 5, we have dinner at 5 o'clock. 10 to 5, it is, you know, wild. You know, and the dinner, you know, the thing to do is make dinner ahead of time, really well in advance, so that, you know, you don't try to make dinner at 10 to 5. It's just, boy. And then when finally dinner is on the table and the kids have eaten, then, you know, relief. So I know Buddhist monastics who really find just maybe they came from that kind of situation, or they understand the life of working and working and working and working and working and working. And they just find such a relief not to have to deal with all the kind of things that many householders have to deal with. And they're just delighted by that. One story which I told it is Ajahn Amaro, who was a Buddhist monk, was being given a tour of some financial district in the United States. And I guess the person was explaining to the American financial system. He's originally from England, so. And his tour guide said at one point, you're wealthier than most people in the United States. And he said, what do you mean? I'm a renunciant. I don't have any money. I'm not allowed to have money. He's given up all, you know, having money. And so what does it mean I'm richer? And he said, the guide said, most people in America are in debt. And you don't have any debt either. So it's kind of a relief, I suppose. So some monastics certainly find certain delight in going forth out of what they consider to be a more confining situation. And in the best senses of the monastic life, it's not an aversion to household life or lay life, but rather it's an understanding of the benefits, the possibilities inherent in that life of simplicity that monastic lives, so that you can engage much more full-time and much more wholeheartedly in a spiritual practice. So going forth, one of the meanings then is to become a renunciant. But it has many other meanings, and not just about becoming monk or nun. But in all the meanings in Buddhism, Nekama is a positive movement of the mind. And it's very clearly stated this way in Buddhist psychology, where they kind of analyze all the different functions of the mind, how the mind works. And they say that nekama is always a wholesome state of mind, meaning that it's never there's never any aversion, ill will, greed, fear, or ignorance or confusion or delusion as part of the movement of nekama, of this going forth or this renunciation. It's also said that that this movement of nekama, of going forth or coming out of one thing and going into another state, another situation, is something that brings greater happiness and greater joy and greater peace to the person who does it. So rather than something that diminishes a person, it's supposed to, something that's supposed to enhance the person. And in one famous quote from the Buddha, he said, if by giving up a lesser happiness, one could experience greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. So given all things are equal, it's not going to cause any harm to anybody, it's kind of implied, that going from a lesser happiness to greater happiness is a good thing. And this movement of nekama is a movement from lesser happiness to greater and greater happiness. Even though it doesn't seem that way, maybe, when we hear some of the things that people will renounce, move out of. So the other thing to say about nekama is that some of the synonyms of this word are things like letting go. And letting go is one of the most important movements of the Buddhist spiritual life. Because the essence of Buddhism is to learn how to let go of clinging. The tendency of the mind to be attached or be stuck, to be rigid, to be fixated. And to move in the direction of the mind or the heart being fluid, relaxed, open, at peace, at rest. Not clinging. And a liberated person, one of the primary definitions of that is someone who has absolutely no clinging in his or her heart. So the movement of letting go is a really important part of spiritual practice in Buddhism. It's not the whole part. Sometimes it's said there's two parts of Buddhist spiritual development that a person has. One has to do with cultivating qualities, and the other has to do with letting go of things, letting go. And sometimes we focus on cultivation, and sometimes we focus on letting go. Sometimes they happen together, synonymously. But letting go is really, in some sense, the essence of it all, because the final liberation of Buddhism is a letting go. There has to be a letting go in order to liberate the heart. So it sounds very good to let go when we feel our clinging, and that our clinging causes us suffering. All clinging, whenever the heart clings, there is suffering. If you cling, you will suffer. If you let go of that clinging, your suffering will stop. That in a nutshell is kind of what the Buddha said. If you cling, you will suffer. If you let go of that clinging, the suffering will stop. So if you see, oh, I'm suffering here. I'm holding on tight to something I shouldn't be holding on to, or I don't need to be holding on. Let me, it seems good then to let go. It seems really good. And so part of what we're doing in Buddhism is training ourselves to let go so we can move into this to open space, move into freedom, into relaxation. One of the very strange things about the process of letting go and going deeper into the joy, the bliss, the delight of free life is that things which are pleasurable, enjoyable, from one point of view, as the practice deepens, they become not pleasurable anymore. But we know a greater pleasure, a greater happiness that now lives in contrast with the earlier one. And the person feels, well, I don't really care so much about that earlier happiness, the earlier delight, because I have this really greater thing going on here. This is really wonderful. And then a step by step, sometimes a path is in one place described as step by step going from kind of a one form of happiness or deep satisfying state, and then realizing its limitations, realizing there's something better, and then moving to something that's better and better. So there can be, for example, in meditation, experiences of joy, a bliss or rapture that arises. Some people get really attached to that. But as the practice deepens, it's necessary to learn how to let go of that rapture. Because the rapture itself is not as satisfying as some of the a different experience, which is called happiness, which is more sublime, more satisfying. And so a person has to learn to let go of something which is pleasurable in order to get something that's even more pleasurable, more satisfying, or more feel more at home, or more settled, or more peaceful in it. So renunciation is letting go, is moving forth out of even not only things which are clearly causing us suffering because we cling, but also learning the skill of how to let go of things which are actually very pleasant. But as long as we hang on to there, stay there, it's going to limit us from going further and more deeply into some greater experience of freedom. Does that make sense? So then we have one, for lay people who are not monastics, there are some specific practices around renunciation or nekkhama, going forth, that are sometimes recommended. And these are usually recommended on a temporary basis. It's fairly common in Southeast Asia for devoted Buddhists to go to Buddhist monasteries or temples on what's called the observance days, on the days when it's kind of like the Sabbath, the Sunday. It's the new moon, the full moon, and the quarter moons. It's about once a week or so. And when they go to the monastery for that day, the lay people will take what's called eight precepts. And these are the five precepts which are central to lay life and Buddhist life, which is not to kill, not to steal, not to involve in sexual misconduct, not to lie, and not to indulge in intoxicants. And in addition to those five, people will take three more precepts. Now, the first five, especially the first four, are clearly ethical in the sense that if you kill, steal, hurt someone through your sexuality, or lie, you're harming someone else. The last three are not ethical precepts, but rather are clearly training precepts that people take on temporarily for the benefits it gives for developing a spiritual life. So I don't know exactly remember how this list breaks down, but they cover things like not eating a meal, any food after 12 o'clock noon, not listening to music or going to shows, or sleeping on high luxurious beds, or adorning the body with jewelry and beautiful clothes. And yeah, that's about it. Not doing those things. For the most part, these are not gruesome things to avoid doing. They're not, you're not being an ascetic. It's not like self-mortification. But some things like not listening to music, spending a day not going to shows, but keeping the day kind of contemplative and quiet, so that the inner life can have a chance to bubble up and surface. One of the aspects of our inner life, spiritual life, if I may, is that it's kind of shy, and it's something which has often a weak voice. And some of the kind of popular currents of life often have much stronger voices in us. All the shoulds and shouldn'ts, and entertainment and television and friends and music and all this stuff that we do to entertain ourselves, and often have much stronger voices. And if we keep ourselves always busy and going, and entertained and stimulated by all this stuff outside, so the mind is always going out in some degree, that shy little voice inside, that it doesn't really have a chance to kind of grow and blossom and come out and show itself. So one of the ways to let this inner life kind of come up is to have a day of simplicity, of quiet, where there isn't a lot of stimulus, not a lot of activity and doing, external kind of doing, to make space for this thing inside. So if we're listening to music all day, going to shows or watching television all day, there's not that space for this inner thing to come out. So one of the practices then in Southeast Asia is on this observance day, is to have that as a day, as a Sabbath, where people keep things really simple. And so they take this precept of renouncing or going forth from, going into the open, quiet space, however you want to translate nekama, by not doing music or shows or things like that. Also not, you know, doing jewelry. You probably can understand a little bit yourself how that simplifies things and lets some other aspect of our psyche do work. If we're concerned about beautification, probably beautifying, adorning, and being concerned how we look for other people or for ourselves can be a distraction from allowing this very shy inner thing to bubble up, being caught up in self-image. So take a day, a week, okay, I'm not going to be, this day of the week, I'm not going to be caught up in self-image and all the activity that goes around it. I'm just going to let myself be as I am. Come as you are kind of party. You know, come in your pajamas or whatever, as you are. And then there's this thing about not eating after 12 o'clock as part of this. There's nothing ethical about eating, nothing unethical about eating at 5 o'clock in the evening. But how it's understood is that it's a helpful training to simplify the day. You don't have to cook. You don't have to cook as much. You can kind of focus more on your practice. Perhaps if you have a tendency to snack a lot neurotically, if you have a precept that says I'm not going to do that after 12 o'clock noon, then you get to see that impulse. You see yourself standing in front of the refrigerator, you know, opening the door, closing it, opening the door, closing it. And, you know, I can't really eat. I took this precept for today. And you can see what this impulse is like. You start seeing what the feelings, the emotions, the beliefs that are behind that, that maybe you wouldn't see if you just had free access to the refrigerator or the freezer. So partly how this functions, these precepts, is a precept to help us understand what makes us tick, how we're attached, how we're clinging. That sometimes is best seen by not having the opportunity to act on our attachment. So that brings us to the one of the more challenging forms of renunciation in the eight precepts for some people. And that is, there's three additional precepts, which I've recited, more or less. But also in the first five precepts, the one about not indulging in sexual misconduct becomes, in the eighth precepts, being celibate. So for the day of being on retreat, being in the monastery, the lay people will take vows of celibacy. We do something similar in our tradition. We don't really have an observance day so much. We don't really do that much here in the West. Some individuals do it, but as a group, Vipassana students don't tend to do this. But the place where we practice celibacy and renunciation in this way is going on retreat. If you go on retreat long enough, after a while you realize it doesn't really matter if you put your lipstick on or not anymore. And people usually stop beautifying themselves and adorning themselves and start doing pretty simple living in a retreat. And one of the rules, one of the guidelines or precepts for being on retreat is to be celibate. And for the most part, that's not an issue. And some people hardly notice they've taken vows of celibacy when they go on retreat because it's 10 days of silence. You're not supposed to talk to anybody for 10 days. And you're not supposed to make any contact with anybody of any kind, except a teacher maybe, but they're off limits. And so you're engaged in your practice in all the waking hours. There's not really the opportunity for sexual activity. So some people don't really notice, but some people notice a lot. Big time. And the frustration, the seeing how their mind is driven by lust and filled with fantasies, and the lust factor kind of can rise up very dramatically in a situation where there's no possibility of pursuing it, or in a situation where you're paying careful attention and noticing it, not distracting you from it, not acting on it in any way. You're also not supposed to masturbate. So some of the pressure is not supposed to be, you don't get relieved some of the pressure. And so you're kind of up against this, in this situation where you really have to confront yourself, this strong impulse, the attachments to whatever is going on there on sexuality. And for some people find that very, very helpful to do. They really forces them to look at a lot of different issues within themselves, forces to look at their relationship to their impulses, to desires, to fantasies, to projections onto other people. There's a lot of different, very rich world that arises for some people when they have to kind of restrain their sexual impulses, or even their sexual, even if they're not going to act on it, even they're not, just they have to really keep it to themselves. So part of the function of renunciation. This word renunciation, nekama, is not only letting go of clinging per se, but putting yourself in situations where you can't indulge in something which maybe is ethically neutral or fine, but which, by not indulging it, forces you to go deeper into yourself and see some of the deeper roots of clinging within us. And one of the things that happens in you'll start seeing if you do a meditative life or pay careful attention to your psyche, is that it's very hard to see certain forms of attachment in their minds. And so certain impulses that might seem very neutral or seem quite benign inside of us, at their genesis, come from some form of attachment, some kind of clinging. And so then, nothing unethical about clinging, so you don't have to think you're a bad person for clinging, but it's just confining to cling. It's just, it's not so comfortable to cling. And nekama has the meaning of going forth into open space, into open, clear, uncontracted, unconstrained kind of heart space, in a sense. So to be able to begin to get quiet enough and still enough and challenged enough to begin seeing the subtler and subtler, more tenacious forms of clinging in our psyche is one of the things that can happen in Buddhist spirituality. And some people will choose voluntarily, temporarily perhaps, to do acts of renunciation in order to get the benefits of simplicity, the benefits of allowing the shy inner aspect of our psyche to bubble up, and to be challenged. And in being challenged, seeing themselves in a way they wouldn't be seen if they weren't challenged. Now, one of the very important things to understand in this world of renunciation or nekama is that it's either directly or indirectly, or either immediately or you see a possibility in the future, it's supposed to bring you a greater sense of peace and a greater sense of joy. It's supposed to be a joy-producing thing. If it doesn't produce joy for you, maybe you shouldn't let go or renounce. Unless you feel like, oh, it's good not to feel joy because now I can really see my stuff and this is good. That's joyful. Great, I can see my stuff. But, so I learned this, when I was a new father, new parent. I had done years of monastic practice, years of Buddhist practice, and I'd learned to some degree relatively well to let go of a lot of things. Things rise, impulses arise, I let go of it. Certain thoughts arise, I can let go of it. Just let go of stuff. Well, when I was a new parent, and kids were, waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I can let go of my sleep, I can let go of this, and all these things I wanted to do, I was used to being able to do, I spent a long adulthood where I was just free to do whatever I wanted. And And I was used to just kind of following my, you know, my desires, my wishes to a certain degree, a certain way. And once I had a child, I couldn't do that anymore. Oh, that's okay. It's fine. I can let go. I just let go. And what I found was that I got, I would get bitter, or annoyed, or irritated, or angry, or furious. And what I learned is that to pay careful attention, that if I'm letting go and I don't feel joy, I should look more carefully. I probably haven't let go well enough yet. I haven't let go of the right thing. Because I could let go, but then this, you know, simmering resentment was still there. And that was not healthy. So when I let go now, I look for, where's the joy? Have I come to a place of greater ease or peace or joy or happiness? And if I haven't, or I don't see how it's going to happen, maybe I need to back up and start over again, or look more carefully, or do something. Because it's not good to let go and end up being kind of resentful. You know, that builds and causes all kinds of unhealthy tendencies within us. It's not so uncommon for people who take vows of celibacy, for example, let go of their sexuality to a certain degree, to end up being angry people. You know, they've let go, but have they really? You know, they haven't really. They haven't let go of the deeper tendencies within us, the deeper impulses or attachments or whatever's going on. So I told a monastic friend of mine, a Buddhist monk, that I was going to be talking about renunciation. And he said to me something like, well, be sure to talk about renouncing sensual desires. And my first thought was, well, that'd be very unpopular. And and why would anybody want to renounce sensual desire? Well, if sensual desire is confining and constricting, then and coming forth out of it into some greater open space of peace or happiness is possible, then why not let go of it? It's great to let go of it. So, you know, one of the aspects of letting go of sensual desire is letting go of sexual desire. What's wrong with sexual desire? Maybe nothing. However, in buying into sexual desire, the impulse, the push for it, the desire for it, have you sacrificed a sense of being at peace, a sense of being rested in yourself? And I know that it's possible, very possible, to have impulse, you know, sexual desire, and then to get all tight and confined, tight about it, and kind of pushing about it, and the things I did when I was a teenager boy. You know, boy, I once went through, I knew the girl's name, first name, and I knew which street she lived on. So my friend and I went through the phone book, him from the front and I from the back, and we called every phone number that had someone who lived on that street. And we asked, you know, is Mary there, or Maria there? I don't know if we got her name, but, you know, how is she there? I mean, no one here by that name. Until we found the house. Well, that was fun. So, I don't know if that was a good example, but I just came to mind of what I did as a teenager. And it's one thing to have sexual desire. It's another thing to lose our peace and well-being around it. And I think a lot of people do. And so the challenge of Buddhist practice for lay people is not necessarily let go of sexual desire, but not to sacrifice some sense of being at peace and content with oneself when the sexual desire arises. So renunciation around sexual desire would take the form of renouncing that part of sexual desire that's causing us to lose our sense of deep well-being, being settled in ourselves, rested in ourselves. Does that make sense? It doesn't mean you've stopped sexual activity, but it means that, you know, all these strange things like, you know, going through a phone book. So I'll read a couple of passages, quotes from the Buddha. And then we can take a couple of questions, perhaps. The mindful ones, the wise ones, who are intent on meditation, delight in the peace of renunciation. So those three words, delight in the peace of renunciation. So renunciation has with it these other qualities, peace and delight. And if those qualities are not there, watch out. Be careful. And then this kind of paean of joy. Ah, so happily we live, we who have no attachments. We shall feast on joy, as do the radiant gods. The radiant gods are a certain class of gods that just live on joy. That's their nourishment. So that's pretty good. So happily we will live, we who have no attachments. We shall feast on joy. Isn't that great? Feasting on joy. And that's what comes when a person no longer clings. The letting go of clinging comes with joy. And that's a wonderful thing to offer our family, our partners, our neighbors, our community, is that joy, that delight in life and being alive, being present, that comes when there's no clinging, when we're free of clinging and happy. Wouldn't that be great? So, renunciation. Was that an unpopular talk? Did I succeed in making renunciation attractive? You're all going to race out and look for the first opportunity. Anyway, your thoughts or questions or reservations, please, anything you'd like to say? Yes? Or let's do the mic. We have a mic nearby?
My question is how it relates to some artists' work. Like there's, I was listening to the...
Can you hold the mic closer?
Classical music station, and they had a story about Beethoven losing a gold coin and getting very angry. And because he was so angry, he wrote this beautiful piece. So taking that as an example, I mean, if he had let go, then that he wouldn't have created, composed that piece. And sometimes you see that in painting artists too.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many portraits that Picasso made. I mean, some of them are full of desire. On the other hand, he gets mad at this woman and turns it into a horrible,
right.
You know. Where was all this art going to be if everybody let go?
The art might look very different. Beethoven still might have written a piece at the same time. You know, at the same time he was writing the angry piece, but he would have written something else. So there's lots of people who perform beautiful art, beautiful music, or are artists, or do very creative things, and they're not motivated by anger or suffering in that act. Now, it's possible that if a person is not suffering enough, some people that they're not going to be motivated to do art. But I would hate to tell someone, I really want you to be a great artist. Go and suffer. It's really good. That's going to create good art. You know, I'd rather the person was happy and not an artist than they suffered in order to make great art. I wouldn't want to justify suffering by the presence of great art. I think there's great art, but there's great art that can happen without that. So what you're pointing to is other people have made the same comparison. And one of the things that's sometimes then contrasted with Western art, people say, well, Western art is often, I have no idea if it's true, but people say Western art is often arising out of people suffering, the artist suffering. But then they say, well, Asia, these great Chinese arts, you know, with nature paintings and all that, it comes out of a very different motivation and impulse. And rather than coming out of some suffering or great anxiety or great conflict that the person's feeling, it comes out of a sense of much more being deeply attuned to themselves, being settled and peaceful. And the artist will spend a lot of time preparing themselves to do the art, and to come into a very peaceful, very, very non-conflictive state. And until they come to that non-conflictive state, they won't do the art. So maybe it produces a different kind of art, rather than heroic marches.
Second part of that question was maybe that's how he was letting go.
Oh, that's true. So the other part of the question is maybe that's the way he was letting go. So sometimes there's catharsis in letting go. You put something down in writing and expresses it, and you can let go of it more easily. That could be a very wise thing to do. And if that's the case, then perhaps we're the beneficiary of that process for him. That's a different justification than saying, oh, the suffering was good, the anger is good because it produced great art. It's saying he needed to do that great art in order to learn to let go. And the side effect of that is that we benefit from having this great music now to listen to. Yeah, so sometimes it works that way. And sometimes expressing, even in art, our anger is a way of just fueling it. So you have to be careful and wise about why we're doing it. Scott?
I've actually thought about this subject quite a bit, and I've always thought that intense pain pushes you into the moment. So while Beethoven was writing this, he was actually being pushed into the present moment, and the expression of the present moment is what came out. It wasn't necessarily his pain. It was that moment. That's just my interpretation of it.
So many years ago, I asked one of my Zen teachers, when I sit Zen meditation, should I sit in full lotus so I can really have a lot of pain because I'm really present? And he said, Gil, no, don't do that. Don't go looking for trouble. But when trouble comes, then be present for it. Don't run away. Well, I hope that this evening's talk was a little bit of a challenge for you. If Buddhism doesn't challenge us, then it's not, up to snuff. It's not really doing its job. And so to be challenged to really look at the area of attachment and clinging, and to look at the value, perhaps, of letting go, and different ways of letting go, and learning how to come out of a confined situation into one that's more open and free. So thank you.